This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The opposition is asking the military to finish the count of the vote of last Saturday.
That's VOA French to Africa Service, Idrissa Fall, who says Gabon's coup leaders met with opposition leaders today, a day after toppling President Bongo's government. Details coming up. Also, the UN says the number of refugees fleeing Sudan has crossed 1 million. And Russia has vetoed an attempt to maintain UN sanctions on military-run Mali. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. In Gabon, a handful of soldiers declared a coup on Wednesday, toppling the government of President Ali Bongo Ondimba. The coup leaders said President Bongo is under house arrest in his residence in the Gabonese capital, Libreville. Scores of people took to the streets in the capital yesterday to celebrate the apparent coup. VOA's Idrissa Fall, with the French to Africa Service, told me a few hours ago that coup leaders met with opposition leaders today, days after Bongo was declared the winner in the country's presidential election.
This morning, the soldiers who took the power, they began meeting the opposition, and the meeting just ended, and the opposition is asking the military to finish the count of the vote of last Saturday, and implying that they want the military to recognize that they won those elections. And in the meantime, also, they asked the soldiers to create conditions to help Gabon have institutions and things like that. They began discussing. That is the latest we have today. And Monday, the General Oligui Nguema going to be sworn in front of the Constitutional Court Monday, September 4th. That is the latest which happened today, and people are still very, very happy in Libreville.
So talk to us a little about the General Oligui Nguema. Who is he?
He's less than 50 years old. He was a general. He's very well respected by the Republican Guard. He served 10 years abroad. He worked in Senegal, attaché militaire, and in Morocco, where he studied in Meknès, because Meknès is a big center of training military, like our West Point down there. And then he came back. He took over the presidential guard. What he did is he widened it, gave them a lot of material, and every day he was with the President Bongo since 2009, and until yesterday, right after they proclaimed that Ali Bongo won the elections, minutes later they took the power.
Talking about Ali Bongo, what is the status of the Gabonese leader, the former president, like we said? He was pleading for help yesterday on video cut. What is going on?
I think if you saw the video, this guy is calling for help and asking his friend to make noises.
Yes.
But he recognized himself that he was in house arrest. He did not know what was going on in his own house. He did not know where his wife was, where his son was, and his son is arrested. So I think it was showing more that this guy, since his heart attack in 2018, is not fit for governing. And opposition had been telling that for years.
He had a stroke, right?
Yes.
And in all this, what is the role of France? What is France saying about all this?
Well, France, when there was this coup in Niger, it was the president, Emmanuel Macron himself, mm-hmm. who came out very strongly against the coup leaders in Niger. But this time, we did not hear anything from Mr. Macron. the Prime Minister, Elizabeth Boone, I think, just said something, coups are not good, things like that. But we did not hear mostly anything from France. Yes, they what they say, they condemn the coup and they want to the respect of the result of the election. But everybody knows those elections, now it's over. And the guy who was re-elected was... and nobody called for the liberation of the president. Nobody called to reinstate Mr. Ali Bongo. So it means that they choose their camp right now.
That's Idrissa Fall of VOA's Fresh to Africa service speaking to me here in the studio earlier today. The head of Gabon's Republican Guards, Colonel Brice Clotaire Oligui-Nguema, has been selected by his peers to lead the country's transition after military officers seized power. David Monda, professor of political science at City New York University, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what prompted the army to plot the coup following a less than accepted presidential election and why the population seems to support the coup.
I think two things. One, that the election was far from free and fair. I think, quite frankly, there was a lot of questions about the legitimacy, the openness, and the fairness of the election. But I think even historically, elections in Gabon have not really been fair. They haven't been free. And there's been a lot of questions asked about the legitimacy of the results of many elections that have occurred in Gabon. But the other question that you address is this whole issue of why does the population then seem to support military takeover, because there's no alternate exit ramp when you have these authoritarian regimes, these corrupt kleptocrats that want to remain in power by hook or crook. There's no democratic process that can exit crisis within the state. And that is why you then have the military as the most organized institution outside of the government that can then replace existing regimes. So this is why I think individuals in Gabon are fed up. They're tired of the corruption. They're tired of the special interests. They're tired of their country being run as a family enterprise. And I think this is where the military has stepped in. What's going to be interesting is what does the military do from now going forward? Will they transition into a more democratic regime? Will they allow free and fair elections to bring in a civilian government? Or will we find a situation like what's happened in Sudan, where you have factions within the military that will then start to jostle and fight for power? Because we have to understand, you cannot look at the Gabon context outside of a regional context. Let's remember, Bongo has very close ties, for example, with the Congo, with Denis Sassou Nguesso. So there's also a regional context in terms of the stability of the country. But of course, you have the other issue of where does France lie within this whole context? Does France support the coup, or does France also have its interest with the previous regime, which has been toppled? I think that's going to become more clear in the days going forward.
Generally speaking, how do you think France would do to face the sequence of military coups in its former colonies in Africa?
France has, particularly since the late 90s, has tended to want to focus more on its continental integration within the European Union, and it's tended to almost abandon its former colonies. But I think there's been a broader awakening within the last 5-10 years within Francophone Africa, that this legacy of French control is really not in the best interest of many of these Francophone countries. But I think the other interesting point I should make here is that the coup plotters, actually in their statement, it addressed Washington, because they made their initial statement in English. And that's also very interesting to hear that they were speaking in English. It seems that they were articulating a message to Washington to say, United States, we have taken over power in Gabon and we need your support. So it's also going to be very interesting for the Biden administration. Where does the U.S. see its hand within the politics of Gabon? Because the U.S. is also an ally with the French. When Biden talks about a rules-based international order and democracy and freedom for the world, will the Biden administration support a military takeover that's then in place to remove an illegitimate regime that's become exploitative and repressive to the people of Gabon? Or will the Biden administration, in cahoots with the French, decide that they want to remove this military regime and they want the Bongo dynasty to continue. I think that will be a huge dilemma for the Bidens, but also for France. Where will France decide that its legacy will be in these former Francophone countries? We know historically the French have used their rapid deployment forces to intervene militarily in many of its former colonies. Will France take the initiative and intervene militarily in Gabon? Or is this a new era when the Macron regime will say that democratic structures need to be in place in Gabon, and whether we have that transition through the military or through other means, that France will stand out? So I think a lot of these external powers, the US and France, we'll have a very interesting dilemma with how to deal with this new military regime in Gabon going forward.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City New York University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The United Nations says 1 million have fled Sudan, confounding expectations about the scale of the exodus triggered by the country's war. While some neighboring states such as Chad and South Sudan welcome refugees, others such as Egypt and Eritrea are pushing them away. Henry Wilkins reports from Renk, South Sudan, and Adra, Chad.
In recent months, South Sudan has received hundreds of thousands of the displaced, mostly returnees of South Sudanese origin, who pass through the town of Renk on the Sudan border here. One, Yana Liwa, said she fled the country with no possessions. She says she fled with nothing in hand, unable to take anything from her home. She says she was living in a makeshift tent, so when the bombs started to fall on her compound, she fled with her family as fast as she could. As thousands continue to arrive in South Sudan every week, Egypt, on Sudan's northern border, has effectively stopped refugees from entering the country. Initially, it allowed around 250,000 to cross its border, but a new rule in June required Sudanese to obtain a visa to enter. Rights groups say this violates international standards, and onerous wait times for visas endanger those trying to flee. Abdullahi Halake is with Refugees International.
Egypt is also experiencing serious economic crisis, and as a result, it is very, very careful in the number of people it's allowing in. And I think this is where, you know, countries like the United States need to lean on Egypt and the UNHCR to ask the Egyptian authorities to allow the Sudanese to come in. But that is not enough.
He added that donor countries must increase humanitarian funding to Egypt if they expect the country to begin taking refugees again. Other Sudanese neighbours, including Libya and Central African Republic, have their own security problems, and few are seeking refuge in either country. Fleeing to Eritrea on Sudan's eastern border would be an even worse choice for those seeking to escape the war, according to Eritrea Focus, a UK-based human rights group. The government is known as one of the most authoritarian and isolated regimes in the world, sometimes referred to as the North Korea of Africa. Habte Hargos is chairman of Eritrea Focus.
And indeed the president has said that the Sudanese people are welcome to come to Eritrea. How many Sudanese have actually taken that offer is unknown. And why would anybody one sick refugee in Eritrea?
As international aid groups are not active in Eritrea, it's unclear whether any Sudanese refugees have arrived in the country. But even for those who have managed to escape, like Bokra Hassan Abdallah, who recently arrived in Chad, the difficulties do not end. She says she was forced to abandon her home because of attacks by Arab militias, adding that her current circumstances, living in a makeshift shelter on the edge of town as a result of her displacement. She says she had to leave Sudan without her identity documents. Lacking identity documents can make it hard for the displaced to register as refugees in Chad, in turn making it difficult to obtain support. As options for where to flee narrow, the number of internally displaced in Sudan is approaching 4 million, almost four times the number of refugees. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adre, Chad.
Some human rights lawyers worry that charges of aggravated homosexuality filed against a Ugandan man in the first case since new legislation was enacted will lead to further prosecution and persecution of gay people. They say the gay community already lives in fear after the draconian anti-homosexuality law was passed this year. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
It is almost a week now since a Ugandan man in his 20s was charged and jailed pending trial for aggravated homosexuality under Uganda's new harsh anti-homosexuality law. Justin Balia, a human rights lawyer at the Human Rights Awareness and Promotion Forum, will represent the suspect in court.
We expect that matter to come up for mention, just for mention, on Friday of this week. I might not be able to tell you but the particular prison in which he is. It's necessary for us to preserve a little bit of privacy for our client to avoid him getting so disturbed by the request. But he's being tried at a chief magistrate's court in Sarawati.
Balia says since aggravated homosexuality is a capital offence under Ugandan law, her team is waiting for the case to be moved to the High Court, which tries such offences, so that they can start on their defence.
We aren't even at the stage yet where we are talking of a defense. He hasn't been committed to the High Court for trial yet, so it's all really preliminaries at this point. So it's not, we're not yet even at the point where it's feasible to plan a defense. And matters of a capital nature like this, we have to wait for the matter to be committed to the High Court for trial before we can even get disclosure so that we can prepare for his defense.
Balia is afraid the case against her client is intended to increase fears among the gay community. Many LGBTQ people are in hiding and others contemplating leaving the country for fear of prosecution and imprisonment. She says her organization has already documented over 10 cases of prosecution of LGBTQ people after the passing of the controversial law.
This case is a huge challenge for the person who is actually charged with it, and for the LGBTQ community, of course, it raises fears because, you know, for a long time we've had the state emphasizing that this law is not really being enforced, but of course we knew that it was being enforced, but to see that a person can actually be charged with an offense that carries a death penalty simply for being queer, it's a whole other level. Of course, it just adds to the tension and the fear that the community has already been living with on a day-to-day basis, and it's not a pretty picture.
There are concerns. The law also could endanger families and associates of LGBTQ people and even their landlords. Uganda's anti-homosexuality law carries the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality, which includes having sex while HIV positive or having sex with disabled people, as well as a 20-year sentence for promoting homosexuality. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Emergency services workers are still searching for bodies in a Johannesburg inner city building where an early morning fire claimed at least 74 lives, 12 of them children. The five-story building was supposed to be a shelter for women and children, but became what authorities call an informal settlement for homeless people. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Some people who were living in the government-owned building threw themselves out of windows to escape the flames. The Inner City Federation's General Secretary, Siyabonga Mahlangu, who helps people facing eviction, stands outside the burnt-out building that had been turned into a maze of shacks.
We saw so many bodies covered with a silver shining plastic of the dead bodies on the road, while there's still firefighters within the building. And then we also saw one person that resides in the property who has the luck to escape that fire.
Mahlangu says the survivor told him while she wasn't sure what started the blaze, there were several possibilities.
Most of them, they were lighting candles at time, and there were people who were warming themselves in something that called imbaula, where they would make a firewood and then sit next to it.
Mahlangu's organization is one of many that works with the occupants of inner city properties that authorities call hijacked buildings. He says his group works with about 50 buildings in the city, but there are many more. He says in most cases, the occupants don't pay rent, but do pay for water, electricity and sewage, if the building has those services. He says he hopes this tragedy spurs city officials to take action.
What I want to see is to see them complying with their own bylaws in terms of bed buildings, also complying with the court orders and judgments that are in place for them to provide alternative accommodation to the occupiers.
Another advocacy group which fights evictions from occupied buildings is the Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa, also known as SERI. SERI Senior Communications Officer Edward Molopi says there's a lack of political will to deal with homelessness.
And so in many of the cases, like you would be seeing them do now, is to act when there's an emergency to provide alternative accommodation. But there isn't a program that speaks to how do we house people in the inner city in a way that is affordable and also decent.
Nkini Chwaku, a member of the Johannesburg Mayoral Committee heading up public safety, told reporters he had never seen anything like it, with some bodies burnt beyond recognition. Johannesburg Emergency Services Management spokesman Robert Mulautsi says the death toll is likely to rise. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Kenya hopes to use the inaugural Africa Climate Summit in Nairobi next week to discuss how to confront the devastating impact of climate change on the continent. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Kenyan President William Ruto says the three-day summit, which kicks off Monday, comes as the African continent faces unprecedented challenges and setbacks on global progress.
Between 4th and the 6th of September this year, Nairobi will host the Africa Climate Summit, where our continent will gather to define and refine its fresh and distinctive position regarding how humanity should engage in effective action in order to save this planet from a climate catastrophe and at the same time lift hundreds of millions out of poverty.
Kenya is co-hosting the inaugural Africa Climate Summit with the African Union Commission in Nairobi. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is expected to attend. Soipan Tuya is Kenya's Environment, Climate Change and Forestry Cabinet Secretary.
The summit will be unique and special, as it will be the first of a kind where all African heads of state and governments are convening under the umbrella of the African Union, dedicated to climate discussions. His Excellency President Ruto is clear that the summit will chart a green growth pathway for the African continent.
As the impacts of climate change continue to intensify, the World Bank reports that millions of people across sub-Saharan Africa are facing extreme poverty and suffering. The increasing exposure to climate change has led to catastrophic droughts in the Horn of Africa, triggering a food shortage crisis exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, a major grains exporter. Ambassador Stephen Jackson is the UN resident coordinator in Kenya.
What we found most inspiring in what the entire Kenyan leadership had to say was that there are important questions to discuss about loss and damages. There are important questions to discuss about climate financing for adaptation. But this is not Africa. This is not Africa coming with the begging bowl. This is Africa coming with solutions and saying we have the solutions not just for the continent, but for the globe.
The establishment of a loss and damage fund was the highlight of last year's UN Climate Conference, or COP27, in Egypt, and the culmination of decades of pressure from climate-vulnerable developing countries. The fund aims to provide financial assistance to nations most vulnerable and impacted by the effects of climate change. Officials say the Nairobi meeting, the first of its kind on the continent, will bring together leaders from Africa and beyond to come up with actions and solutions for tackling climate change while prioritizing Africa's development agenda. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Barrow, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.